country. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. If you have not done so, there are snacks over at the table. Help yourself. And at this time, I would like to call Representative Lynn Lundquist and forward, and he has a presentation. And Lynn, if you, Representative Lundquist is responsible for the working quality education model. When he was speaker 2 years ago, he put together the council and those individuals worked on it. And Lynn, you might also want to introduce, when you finish your presentation, your panel.
Well, thank you, Chairman Winters, for the opportunity to come before this committee this evening. It's indeed a privilege and to be able to sort of lead off here on what I consider to be the revolutionary funding of K-12 education in the state for the future. It sets the foundation, and maybe right at the very end I'll speak about where I think this model can drive us. Keep close to this. I'm getting the message here. Using my voice, I'm having trouble doing that. But before I introduce some of the members that are here this evening and will take part in the presentation, I want to give you a little background of just how this particular model, the genesis of it was born, if you would. I want to go back to 1995 when I was in my freshman year as a legislator, went through the funding process as we always do, have for years, for many biennials in education funding, and perhaps those who have been there longer than I had understood the process a little bit better than I did, but certainly as a freshman it was a very frustrating experience. I can remember doing exactly the same thing in a sense that has gone or that happened in 1997 and somewhat is happening again in this biennium, and that is of trying to make some real hard decisions of how much money we ought to put in K-12 funding. There was never a discussion about how much was the right amount. There was never a discussion that really got very far above the threshold of saying how many dollars do we have. We have to balance the budget to get out of the session, and let's see how much money we can put in K-12. That, frankly, is how the system has worked over time. I remember in 1995, right after the session, going down to legislative revenue and fiscal, and some of you may know Jim Scherzinger, who is now working for the Portland School District, and John Latimer, who was in the legislative fiscal office at that time, who is now the state auditor, working on the Secretary of State. But at that time, they were the directors of the Department of Legislative Revenue and Legislative Fiscal. I remember going down and talking to them after the session was over and saying, isn't there a better way to fund education? And we had a healthy discussion about that, and I remember Jim Scherzinger particularly saying, well, it's been tried. In fact, he said Dr. Boyd Applegarth was a person who tried this in the late 1980s. In fact, I believe the Board of Education asked him to do that, to try to develop some system whereby we could fund education based on something other than just simply bringing the forces together and dividing the pie, as we always talk about. And I remember the frustration at that time, but I didn't know what to do about it. And so when I became speaker in the 1997 session, and we started through the same process, and I remember sitting at the table in the office there, and after we'd had a healthy discussion about how we're going to fund education, and I remember I turned to my chief of staff, Margaret Hunt, and said, there's got to be a better way to do this. This is just simply is unacceptable. We have to do something different. And so that was the genesis, really, of the committee that put the quality education model together. Because I maintain that the way we've always done it is that we simply take the last budget, we had the inflation, we had the student population growth, and then we had the squeak of the wheel. And in most cases, the squeak of the wheel is the one that drives the system more than anything else. When you do that, you do not make judgments based on good facts. I remember last session when some people from the Portland School District came to me, some business people and educators, and they said they wanted, if I recall, $4.3 billion. And I remember then, it was fairly early in the session, maybe March or something like that, or February probably. And I said, why should we give you $4.3 billion? Well, they didn't really know, except they needed that much to make their budgets work. But when you ask them, what does it do for education, what's an education cost, there was really no answer. And probably in about three weeks later, they came back, and I always remember they had one single piece of paper. And on that piece of paper, they had laid out why they wanted $4.3 billion. Well, this is not to be negative to their endeavors at all. They were absolutely sincere. They did go home and do a little pencil pushing and decide why they needed $4.3 billion. But they never really convinced me that we ought to get that figure based on what they had on the sheet. Rather, as we went through the session, I'm proud of the fact that we did fund education at I believe, the best level we could. But I still had the nagging questions in my mind. Was it the right amount? Was it too much? Was it too little? I really had no idea. So that's why this council was put together. And success of the council, I absolutely believe, is the fact that we were fortunate enough to, what I think, make a tactical decision that was appropriate, and that is that we decided that we would bring in a cross-section of members of the Oregon, and we stayed away from the bureaucrats. We stayed away from the legislature to a great degree. We only had three members of the legislature on there because I believe it was the people of Oregon that needed to decide. And people who had the expertise and the willingness to make that decision. And so, I guess you do have the big packet before you now. I see some of you do. Is the big one there? Not everyone. They're still making copies. Okay, I was looking around. I see some and some I didn't, so I didn't know what it was. But anyway, you see when you look in that, the list of the members of that council, of the ongoing council. And what we did, we tried to pick principals and superintendents and teachers and school board members and business people and parents and citizens, so that we had a cross-section that was not only from the standpoint of the input that was into it, but I thought after the model is developed, you need to be able to have a confidence level with the people of Oregon that it has been formulated in a scientific manner. It's been put together with a group of citizens that had a standing in their communities, that had the ability to go out and tell Oregonians about the model. Now, let me give you one other little explanation about this and why I think it's so valuable. Last session, and some of you at this table were there last session, some of you weren't, but when we funded education $4.3 billion, I can remember, and I think Reverend Sinceri and Reverend Uberlau, and I'm probably missing someone here to look around the table, but you were there, and we talked about we're going to put $50 million in for textbooks, and we're going to put $150 million in for capital expenditures, quote-unquote. They were lottery bonds. But one thing we wanted to make sure that they were one-time expenditures. And the reason they're one-time expenditures in the eyes of the legislature was so that when next session comes along, you don't roll those costs up. Well, you might say that's a reasonable goal to delineate, you know, what is one time and what is not one time. And I'm excusing you. I missed Reverend Decker. He was sitting right there. I don't know how I went by you. If I know he was here last time as well. I probably missed another one, and I'm embarrassed about that. I apologize, Reverend Decker. But the reason is because we aren't talking about what an education should cost. We don't even mention those words. We simply say, what's the roll-up cost? Because we want to be careful we don't get locked in the box for next time. But we don't ask the basic question. That's why, again, this time I hear people talking about, well, they're talking about bonding and so forth. Well, now is it going to be one-time cost or not? ladies and gentlemen, we have to get out of the mode of thinking about what is a one-time cost, how do we balance the budget. We have to think what a quality education should cost in the state of Oregon. And that was a charge that the council was given. And let me emphasize the word quality. And when I say what education should cost, it's implied that that education should be sufficient to allow our students to reach the high standards that we have set for them, that the legislature has mandated that we put in education reform. And that brings me to my last comment, then, I think, before I introduce the panel, and that is the process that we went through. The process that we went through was very, very tough. Because we were plowing virgin soil, we did not know exactly where we were going. We did not know how to get there, and so we struggled. And I'll have to tell you, it was not a pretty picture. And there were many times that we wondered if we were on the right course or not. But the vision I had originally is exactly what came out of this, except there's more depth, there's more confidence level, there's a higher level of confidence in the report than I thought there might have been for the original draft that was to come out. But when we went through that process, the first major decision that we made, and it's critical to the process, and that was, what was going to be the basis for a quality education? And we asked the question, and we had lengthy discussions, was education reform the basis or not? We were already in education reform. You know, we've been here since 1991, quote unquote, even though in reality it has not been. But we certainly were in it 2 years ago when we were undertaking this endeavor. And after much discussion, so that everyone was comfortable, and in the end there was one that wasn't comfortable, that education reform was the basis and is the basis for this model. And if there are those who do not like education reform, you very well may not like this model. We were not out to reinvent the wheel. We were simply to take what we believed was a good foundation, a very viable foundation for the education of our students, and we needed to build on that. Now, we enhanced that model, we analyzed the model, we costed it with a whole lot of things. But that was and is the foundation of the Oregon Quality Education Model. In that process, we didn't answer all the questions that came up. And we have some unanswered questions or some questions that we're really working on at the present time, because this council will continue to go forward to finish these particular endeavors. We have not tackled the question of capital costs. We had a work group. We had four work groups, actually. One of the work groups dealt with special education. In fact, if you look at the model, you will see there's a line item there for the high cost, low incidence kind of students, because we believe that is so significant in the funding of the education of the state that we had to treat it a little bit differently. But there's a lot of work to be done yet that one of the subgroups is working on. We are continuing over time to review the costing of the elements that go into this model. Let me remind you that this is not a model that is the model in a static nature. It is a living, breathing model that will continue. My hope is for a long period of time. I can't understand why it will quit. I think why it should ever stop at some point, but it will be constantly revised as the council works with it and as future members work with it. Because it is not the answer. I don't want anyone to think that I'm suggesting that it is from the standpoint it is the final answer and now it can go home. But this council continued to work. There's three other areas that the subgroups of this council have continued to work with. The ESDs, certainly they are very much a part of the system, the cost of living aspect, and we're looking at the state salary schedules or something along that line of statewide collective bargaining as well. And then we are will make a major impact yet on the accountability aspect of this and how it relates to the model. Accountability, the funding that goes into the process. You may hear some things and may repeat this a little bit tonight, but I want you to give out that overview because I think it's very important that you understand the background of how this model is developed and where we want to go. And before anyone gets too excited, particularly some of the education leaders around this table, as I understand, we have teachers, many teachers here, and that was the nice part about the council put together. A good many of the members were teachers in the classroom at one time. Some were still there, but a good many of them were in that process, so we had a nice cross-section of that. With that, I think I'll introduce some people that really drove this model, because this model is not, and let me clarify that before you, so you can wipe this out of your mind, so you don't think of this in the negative or in this aspect during the presentation. It is not a disbursement allocation model. It is not a prescriptive model. It does not tell teachers what they have to do. So I want you just to have that overview that is what it does not do. This is a funding model. This determines the total revenues that are needed. With that, I'd like to introduce, first of all, Dr. Dave Conley, who has done a tremendous amount of work on putting the final product together, has been on the council. I have with me also Peggy Lynch. Peggy's over here. Has been extremely tenacious through this process. I don't know if Peggy is there in the meetings or not, but I don't think so. And then we have Sal Cox as well. And I'm looking around. And Audrey Rose is sitting back here. I didn't even see him. He's hiding in the second row. But these are the people that I'll ask to join. Some of them to join with me this evening. And with that, Dr. Conley, if you'd like to take over, please. And
my name is Dave Conley. I'm an associate professor at the University of Oregon, and I've also been involved as consultant to the council working on the quality education model. What I'm going to do is, in a moment, introduce you to Nancy Heiligman and folks that she's working with to give you an overview of the database initiative. And I think it's important for you to understand the database initiative for two reasons. There's a policy reason, and there's a very practical reason in terms of understanding this model. The policy reason is to understand that in Oregon, we're beginning to collect information about schools in ways that allows, and in fact is going to cause, comparisons between schools. The database initiative is a project, Nancy will explain it in more detail. In essence, it causes schools to report their expenditures in standardized fashion. In other words, there will be information about how schools allocated their money and to what purposes. And it's important to understand that because in the policy context, because in a practical sense, that helped to provide a lot of the initial data for the quality education model. And even as we proceed with the model in future years, the database will provide more of this type of information, which is real information about real costs, real expenditures in real Oregon schools. So I think it's important to get that overview of how we came to get a number of our cost estimates and in the future how we believe the database will provide more precise estimates in other areas. The second principle I think that's important to keep in mind is that the policy environment in Oregon is changing and has been changing this entire decade in a way that's difficult very often for us, all of us, in education, the public sector, other places in the society to see. But we started changing things in this state, and we changed one thing, and a lot of times it caused a lot of other changes that nobody even anticipated. In 1990, in November of 1990, when ballot measure 5 was passed, I don't think many Oregonians sat down and said, by golly, I want to get rid of local control of my school district. I don't think many Oregonians sat down and thought about a lot of the implications of that particular ballot measure. My point is not that it was good or that it was bad. I'm not advocating or in any way casting aspersions on that particular decision made by the electorate. My point is that It had many secondary, tertiary effects. One of the effects was to move control of funding from the local level to the state level, from about 70% of the money coming from property taxes, and about 30% from the state, to about 70% of the money coming from the state, and about 30% from the local district. This changes the dynamic in the policy-making arena, so that in 1999, we're asking ourselves, how can the legislature make better decisions about funding? We wouldn't have been asking that in 1990 or 1991. We would have been asking ourselves, how does the state not get in the way of the local school district? So we can't deny the fact that this policy shift has occurred. But what we can do is try to develop an intelligent system that maximizes the effectiveness of local school districts in the things that they can do best and allows the state to support that process as opposed to dominating or mandating in ways that don't make sense. And to do that, you need to have a sense about what you want from your education system. We have, as I said, a database that will generate information about costs. We have a set of state standards and assessments that will generate information about performance. And whether we like it or not, we have the elements in place to talk about how our schools are doing, not only in terms of what they spend, but what happens as a result of spending it. The quality education model does not get in the business of telling schools what to do, but it does begin to try to think about what is adequate, what the schools need to be successful in an environment where they're going to be judged in ways that they haven't been judged before. So let's begin by looking at the database initiative, and Nancy and her folks will take you through that. I will come back then and spend a little time taking you through the model. This will also allow, I think, some more time for the copy machine to chug away. I'm not sure everyone yet has a copy of the overall report, and I think that's going to be necessary. Does everyone have one now? Okay. And we'll just make sure everyone has a copy of that. So Nancy, we'll let you go ahead and get going.
One moment, please. Last week, or 2 weeks ago, we were given the Oregon Quality Education Draft. Is it being replaced by what we have today?
Correct.
Correct.
So you're getting an updated model. Draft.
So what we have from 2 weeks ago is set aside. We're not working on that today.
Just on the basis of our presentation today, we've been walking through this and we have to just replace the Karen was then working to complete this report, and this is the most current and closest to the report.
Thank you.
They're very similar.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Nancy Heiligman. I'm the project manager for the Database Initiative Project. I am on leave currently from my position as the finance director for the Eugene School District, and I've been working with the Department of Education for the past 18 months on this project. Let's go through the agenda. We have a very brief presentation for you today. We'll try to take about 20 minutes and give you some background and history on the project, explain exactly what the database is, and then also talk about possibilities for a statewide implementation of the database. First thing that you should know about this project is that it has been a very inclusive process. This is not something that could have been successfully done in the back room. And there were many, many stakeholders involved. First, staff from Legislative Revenue and Legislative Fiscal, from the Governor's Office, from school organizations, COSA, the Oregon School Boards Association, school business officials. Also, our contractor on the project was selected from three finalists in a procurement process, and that is KPMG. And Mike Hess of KPMG is here today also and will help with the presentation. So, as I said, this was there was a lot of involvement from school districts and from policymakers in Salem. We also worked with, in addition to working with this committee, we also reported a number of times to the emergency board during the interim, and were directed by the e-board to work closely with the legislative council that was drafting this quality model so that the database would be able to provide the facts and the information that that committee would need. The database project is a pilot project. The department took 16 school districts across Oregon, actually 15 districts and one ESD to work on the project. And they were a diverse group, with the largest being Portland. Our smallest is Mitchell School District in Wheeler County, but we did try to get a cross-section in terms of geography and size and student demographics and educational programs. There are about 30% of the students in Oregon represented within the pilot district. These pilot districts worked very hard on this project to gather the data and to make it consistent. A little bit about the background, the reasons for the project. The impetus was House Bill 3636 passed in the last session, and that bill directed the Department of Education to update the school finance chart of accounts. These are the account codes that schools use, and the purpose was to get more consistent data. There was some frustration at the state level that school districts were not accounting for their expenditures and revenues in the same ways, and so that it virtually made comparisons across districts impossible. And in addition to that, the bill required that schools report at, or that districts report at the school level rather than at the district level to the state. And so there was the requirement for more consistency, more detail. And then the bill also required that we place this information in a database and make it accessible to the public through the Internet. And so that was the impetus for the project. In response to the bill, the department proposed a pilot project, because this is a very significant undertaking for school districts, and that we include other types of data other than just financial data in this database. So you'll see as we go through this, there's information on student staff, student performance, other types of information in this database other than just financial. We broke this project into four parts, and those are that update to the chart of accounts, and that was something that really occurred early in the project. We worked with committees from the school districts and groups of stakeholders. The development of this database, there wasn't a database that existed. The department had several little desktop databases that really couldn't talk to each other. And one of the frustrations was that we really already had quite a bit of data about schools in the Department of Education, but it was just hard to get it out of these little databases and, you know, and provide consistent information. Database loading, another issue is that the department right now collects about 200 paper reports from school districts, and that part of this project was to automate that collection of data, particularly if you're going to gather financial data at the school level. You can't really send that in manually anymore. That's lots of data, and it's much easier for school districts and for the department if that is automated. And so that was another part of it. Then the last, of course, is the Internet reporting, creating reports so that this data is available to policymakers, to school districts, to parents, to the public in general. Then we'll just move through these four parts and talk a little bit about what was accomplished in the pilot. First, the update to the chart of accounts. The pilot districts made proposals for changing the chart of accounts. And I need to tell you that this wasn't creating a new computer system for school districts. This was merely a way of coding the accounting information so that it was more consistent. And we worked to get agreements about how to account for certain things. A good example would be staff development costs. In the previous chart of accounts, and there was an accounting manual already in the state, it just hadn't been updated in about 10 years. Staff development, for example, districts charged that all in all over the board, lots of different accounts. And so if you wanted to compare staff development costs in one district or another, it was just virtually impossible. So the districts really worked on some compromises and agreed on how we were going to do various accounting kinds of work so that those comparisons can be made. Again, no big programming changes, but more just how we do our work. Let's see. The other thing that we did is extensive training throughout the state for school districts. Once the pilots worked on a proposal, we presented it to districts around the state. Every district had a chance to give input into the process, and once that was finalized, then for this upcoming budget year, 1999-2000, all school districts are implementing this new chart of accounts and making those changes. It was adopted by the state board last December, and districts are right at this very minute actually working on their budgets for next year with those new account codes. The other second part was database development, and this just gives you a picture of the types of data that you'll see in this database. The financial data, there is some information on budgets, and actually we have some high-level budget information for every school district in Oregon because it was available at the Department of Ed. And then we have very detailed expenditure and revenue information for the pilot school districts. And this is all for the 1997-98 school year, the one just passed. And then in addition to that, we have information on staffing, student demographics, infrastructure, student performance. And I think that's about it. But all of those data are at the school level and provide a picture of each school, not only just in dollar terms, but in terms of the kinds of resources that districts are allocating at the school level. Now I'm going to turn this over to Mike Hess to talk about the other parts of the project.
Thanks, Nancy. Chairperson Winters and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Michael Hess, Senior Manager with KPMG and KPMG's Project Manager for the Database Initiative Project. Just to pick up where Nancy left off, the third major component of the pilot project was an infrastructure to automate the collection of data from the pilot districts. And within the scope of the pilot, this involved the automatic or automated data collection of financial data from the pilot districts, such that, as opposed to filling out forms and so on, the data could be formatted in a way that it could be sent via the internet to ODE, to the project, where it is validated and loaded and ultimately streamlines the process quite a bit. That was the third component. The fourth major result of the pilot was the creation of the web-based reporting capability. And many of you may have had occasion to see this. A a website as part of the Department of Ed's webpage that allows roughly 27 reports that cover the breadth of information that Nancy just described to allow all the project stakeholders, legislators, educators, the public, virtually anyone who can hit the public internet to see a very broad array of data that is generated dynamically at that time, not just reports that were produced sometime in the past. And there's a great deal of capability there, which I think will allow a lot of information to be disseminated to those who require it. With regard to the data that's available, the call your attention to the top of the matrix here, primarily for the legislative session, with regard to the January 99 legislative session, have roughly 97, 98 data for the 16 pilot districts. The plan would be for the January 2001 legislative session that, in addition to that, you'd have 98, 99, and 99, 2000 statewide data, in addition to that of the 16 pilot districts. So there will be a good bit of data should the database project go forward, which will provide this multiple year of data repository, which will feed this reporting and decision-making and potentially the modeling effort. Okay. And with regard to... The pilot project, the intent would be, or the plan as part of the pilot project was to develop a plan for the statewide implementation. And that plan has been put together to identify what the approach would be for taking the pilot project forward to encompass all of the districts in the state. And there are a number of tasks that are planned to expand the breadth of the database to include additional data elements required for modeling and decision making, to expand the reporting capability, to review business processes with regard to the automation of data collection. There are opportunities then to streamline those business processes, and to also put in place any technical infrastructure components that are required to support this. And that would be the plan for the statewide implementation of the database. And as has been mentioned previously, that database could be used then to support subsequent efforts with regard to the modeling and to provide data for decision making and further reporting of education data, as well as the streamlined data collection. And as I mentioned, there's a website that is available off the Department of Ed's webpage where, in addition to the reporting capability, other descriptive information regarding the chart of accounts and other project information is available. And I think I'll turn it back to Nancy.
Just a quick question. When you looked at the loading or the 200 plus pieces, did you also look at redundancy or cull some of those pieces of information?
Madam Chairman, I think there's a great opportunity to eliminate some of the redundancy that we have in the manual reporting and to really streamline the processes between the school districts and the department. That's something that's very exciting, I think, about the second phase of the project.
Thank you.
And all I wanted to say in closing is that this is our website address. We'd really urge you to take a look at our reports. We're very proud of our website and what we've accomplished in the last 18 months, and would be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Are there any questions?
Yes, I think so.
Representative Wilson.
I wanted to ask, has DOE shared with you how many website hits they're getting on the databases themselves? On a daily basis.
Representative Wilson, Madam Chairman, I haven't looked at it recently, but over the past year, we've been averaging about 500 hits per month. And I think it's probably more than that now in the last couple months because we've finished the project. One point that I didn't make that I would like to is that we were very fortunate to, in our purchasing process, to hire KPMG as contractors on this project. They have done similar projects around the country and were instrumental in building the architecture and working in every phase of the project. And we did look at several other vendors and some off-the-shelf software packages from both IBM and Coopers and Lybrand. And KPMG has done an outstanding job on this project and brought it in on budget and on time. So the department's been very pleased with that.
Yes.
I'm sure you know the reaction of the private district and how they felt about the data that they wanted to be helpful for what is more comfortable and how they treated the more important information.
The pilot district actually did a lot of extra work that in the statewide implementation other districts won't have to do because they kind of implemented this midstream in the middle of 97-98. And I think it was mixed. Some districts had no trouble at all and are very excited about it. Other districts struggled and we learned a lot about how the department needs to work with districts if this is implemented statewide, and that was a lot of the purpose of the pilot. For example, we had a small district, and the business manager broke her arm and couldn't input the data. I mean, it's those kinds of things that happen in small districts where they're going to need extra support and help to make the changes.
It was voluntary.
Yeah, it was voluntary. No one was forced into this. And I really can't say enough about the work that those districts have done because they were kind of the trailblazers for the other school districts and did spend extra time in committee work as well as just implementing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Report in front of you, and what I'll do is
advice that go along with the handout that you have. And I'll try to go back and forth between the two a little bit. And in that fashion, just give an overview. So, once again, those of you who are more black than others, you remember black and white definition. I think it gave you a little bit of overview about what I think of policy differences between now and 1991, which I 1991, I marked the watershed years of learning. And it's suggested to you that we're going to get the policy environment. And as I look at the quality education model, I think it's have two ways to look at it. And look at it from the point of view of, well, what's wrong with this? I think it's a good way to look at it. Or you can look at it from the point of view of, if we didn't have this, we'd end up eventually with something like it. Something that's perfect to talk about, the state getting handled on what it costs in place. And if you look around even in this legislature, this session, what's the bill? Biologically, it's designed to control the cost of schools, but somehow to anticipate what the cost will be next session. As soon as we get to raise this, starting to say, how do we, when we show up 2 years in, how do we know roughly what the schools will have spent, or where they'll be in their spending, or what they'll need? So in that sense, the model is one way to do it. Sure, there are other ways to do it, but it's an outgrowth of policy change, not just for the good intentions of a council or any particular group of people. The history on this, if you go back a bit, was that the governor started a group about 6 to 8 months before that then Speaker Lonicklay started his group. And the governor had basically the same thing in mind. The governor's motivation was a little different. He came from this from the point of view of saying, the Oregon Health Plan is able to say about how much it ought to cost to preach to offer health services. Can we do that with education? Can we come up with a sense of what the costs are of education? Put those in some sort of a priority list. We could say we could plan with a certain level of health. And I was on that first group with the governor along with four other folks. And we did explore a lot of those issues. And it gave me a chance, I think, to maybe get a little running head start on them and think about them a little bit more. Representative Lundquist put his group together. And in that process, it became clear that some principles were going to have to get different. I'll try to point those out as we go through that education is different from healthcare for a variety of reasons. But we have to think about a model that makes sense for schools, not just a model that makes sense for government. We can apportion the cost of service in government pretty easily in some areas. I think you can probably figure out about what it costs to take a mile of highway, and then you adjust it for different factors, like whether it's a bridge, whether it's an urban area, and so forth. It has been, up until the present, much more difficult to talk about the cost of schooling, particularly the cost of schooling in relationships, and even like particular results. So that's what the model tries to get through. That's the genesis of it, and the seeding of it. And as I think the motivation for it is important policy. Some of those points are raised. I would call your attention to the in the March report that you have. If you haven't, this is very similar, by the way. I should mention this here. It's not present. And I call your attention if you haven't had a chance to look at it to the page, what is page 11 in this one hand number. Right after page 17. Jason has to comment on our mathematical ability. And that's the deal with one person's computer. But beginning on that page, you'll get descriptions of the numbers. One of the things that you will be taken by is the diversity of background, diversity of experiences. But I'd say more than anything else, the one thing that comes through to me, the commitment to the state of Oregon, the well-being of the state of Oregon among these people. You can look at those individuals and I think say these are people who have to invest both their lives and careers to try to extent to making this place a better place to live, better policies, better schools. I think that's an important framing and sort of concept to keep in mind that thinking about keeping what is profit. I mentioned some of the reasons why we need a model. Kind of our cost. Product enables schools to do tricky things too. And we use education reform as our basis. In part because one of the things that I've learned over the last 10 years is that teachers say you cannot expect us to do things if you do not provide a student. And that teachers also say no one has really sat down to try to figure out what it would take to do all these things that were mandated in 1991 and 1992. And that's where we began our activities. But we went beyond that. We said that it should not simply be the achievement or the attainment of the educational standards and assessments. We don't want schools that force children to spend all their time studying for tests and don't develop a whole child. If there are other aspects that Oregonians expect for their children, they want for their children, they want their schools to be more than satisfactory. And in fact, our students, by and large, are good students. They are not bad students. They have challenges to face them, but they're good groups. And we need to give them a broad set of opportunities, not just a narrow set. And so we define the element of a quality education as being what you need to get to the standards. But in addition to that, what are the elements of what the education lays out, from its materials, and talks about the education goals for the state, what are the key elements of that book that we've identified in the state, key policy elements that we've defined, and those are contained in here as well. I can't always flip right through the page. But we have, in fact, listed those. Beginning on page 44, follows page 43. I'm going to show you that we're not consistent. And you'll see that we have components of quality learning. We have academic content and curriculum as defined by the Board of Education, performance standards, and so forth. Developmental goals on page 47. A number of pieces that we define to use as a when we consider what should the school that we design, the school walls we design, be able to do. Sorry, you remember your points already, continue to not repeat them. The model combines
Can I ask a question? Based on what you said and what I've kind of seen here, it doesn't look like that you address readiness for starting school.
Absolutely correct. You see, there's a lot of things about the state policy that go beyond the charge of the council. I think it's important that you will consider about what our charge is.
Okay.
And that the kind of issue you've created there is the kind of thing that I think ought to be engaged. But the danger that we had was, were we to move outside, give you a couple examples of tricky, were we to move outside of our charge, we could very quickly have moved in areas where we couldn't have, it had an influence. For example, schools that teach federal money. And we said, we're not going to talk about those federal money. Schools, you see, DSD money. We're not going to talk about those monies either. But, we said, those are critical to the education of students in the school. Which would be readiness to learn in the form of further child with education. Also 3565 set as a goal that all students who are eligible for Head Start would have that opportunity. Now, depending on how you figure it, we're closer than we were, but we have not necessarily systematically engaged that priority that we said in 1991. So, we talked about the database. How it allows comparison. Well, the EDD model also looks at another thing that we're going to talk about schools and relationships to one another. And I think that can be a terrifying concept in this case. But I would once again discuss the point I made in my introduction, which is schools are going to get compared. They're going to get compared to the country of Oregonian. If you don't believe me, let's meet again in the middle of September. And I think we'll probably all be on the same page. And what I'm doing, and literally and figuratively, and what I'm suggesting is that we need to take control of the ways by which we talk about school comparisons as opposed to what I call lowest common denominator comparisons, where they just rank them all by the numbers and then make a decision. we're talking about a tool that allows us to think systematically about what they've done and how they relate to the expectations we might have for them, the directions we might have for them. Now, Burke there wants us to emphasize a couple points that are worth saying again very quickly. This is not about some school how to spend their money. It's very about that. Both these, but the quality education model is that you have to have 20 to 1 classes, you take them in 20 to 1. That's going to mean that everyone's going to run out and do 20 to 1 classes. The conversations I've had with school people, and I've worked in the state for 10 years in public education, effective education policies. I've done a lot of research on all these issues. I know a lot of school folks. When I talk with them, what I'm told is, no, and our district wouldn't do that. It wouldn't make sense to do that. You know, put money into K-3 all along. We're closer to the benchmark than a lot of people. We do it differently. So the notion that the state would come in and say, no, sir, you have to do this at all. That your local district, you have the best reason of what you ought to be doing to make that decision. This is not about changing the way money is distributed to schools, although I think it's going to raise issues about that. I think we should be frank about that. But right now we distribute based on per pupil plus weighting. If you're familiar with the weighting system, we provide extra money to certain categories of pupils. Special education pupils weighted at 2 times the regular cost. ESL students, I'm going to give them the percent again on those, it's 0.6 to the gap, 5. RV students, 0.25. And I'm missing foster child gets a weighting and a couple of
Team care.
And in essence, we create a so that we have two counters. We have a count of regular moment, and then we have another count of waiter. And then the difference is about 80,000. So we have a lot of ways in which we distribute the money out based upon special categories that we say we need models to get the money before. The model does not address weighting. What it does is create, it rolls the weighting together in the moment. It assumes that when the money goes out, then there will be some difference. But schools are not. And this is not a model about how to come up with some money. This is not a government tax proposal or anything else. We were not charged with coming up with a politically viable method of delivering any recommendations. And he said, let the chips fall where they may. Let us decide. And the political statement, the numbers that were on the basis of what that civilian amount is too high. That was not our goal, was to make headlines, and our goal wasn't to try to convince people that somehow you get excellent schools if you just got to 5.1 or 5.2 or 5.0. That wasn't the goal. It was to say, why is this wrong? When you get it right, when you figure out where. So we determined that we took a look at the various aspects of what it takes to get high academic standards. The way we did this is by thinking of individual school buildings. What I called initially hypothetical schools, and I think it was an important word to use. A lot of people thought like that doesn't communicate real well. Out in the world of newspapers and so forth. But what I mean with hypothetical school was to emphasize the fact that it wasn't supposed to be any particular school in Oregon. We were not going to go to Web Clothing and find a school that is the most like our model and pull it out and say, if everyone were like this school, we'd all be okay. What we did was say, we're going to create these hypothetical schools that have all these components. And the assumption was, if you put the components in, and the components then are more than the sum of the parts. Not just, this is not a mechanical model, it is an integrated model. It says when you do these things in combination, it's a likelihood that a lot of kids are going to get these standards. And even we're bold enough to try to talk about a number. We took that criticism for doing that, but we're trying to make a point. We're trying to make a point that you eventually have to start talking about a relationship between inputs and outputs. What you spend, how you organize instruction, how you conduct it, and what happens as a result. And we're not here to try to sell you a number that says if you put X dollars, you're guaranteed X performance. What we're trying to tell you is this is the first step towards learning about the relationship between how we, what we spend and beyond money, what happens subsequently, and to begin to learn how to understand that relationship better. Not in the way that punishes schools, but in the way that schools in partnership learn how to make these levels of performance happen. At the same time, the state provides the resources. It's a partnership operating, not some sort of adversarial relationship. This is not New Jersey. We do not need to go in and take over schools in my estimation. I can't think of three schools in Oregon that are in that type of situation. It's about a good school system getting much better, in my estimation. And that's the perspective that we've taken, not a deficiency perspective. How do you design a model to deal with all these terrible schools? It's how do you create a picture of what you want, and then how do you fund it? Individual schools are the unit of analysis. They're the unit of analysis in the same subject. When you receive your scores, you'll receive on a school-wide basis, not a classroom, not a district basis, a school basis. And if you are a teacher in a school district, you will be, all of you, will, your school will not be compared to the one down the road. You will be compared to schools hundreds of miles away from you in the state. It's a new relationship between you and the state. And you can't think the old days, 5 years ago, the old days. Now, the district set the rules, and basically you follow them, and you were pretty good teacher, you did a pretty good job, and we're happy with you. The new world is one where you will be compared to other schools in Oregon of similar nature of your own, similar characteristics that you have. You're going to be compared in that way. So when we talk about a hypothetical school, or as the name of also a prototype school, we're talking about a way to think about ideal performance, not the performance of any of your schools individually, because we don't want individual schools to get compared to part of that. We just want this as a way to think about this state provides the kind of resources that we need to be successful. And if you make the kind of decisions you need to make that, new and different roles. So there's a way to provide some guidance, some pictures, partnership relationship on how to improve.
Dave, just, could you talk a little about back again, why you took school culture, the fact you tried to, one time you tried to talk it out and pursue it?
What was the reason that
you
picked the school? For example, when I was a research on the second school, very strongly that school is property under the when you talk about improvement. That within a school, teachers may be better or worse. But if the effect of a student going through an instructional program in a school is stronger than an individual teacher. So it doesn't make so much sense to compare teacher to teacher as it does to compare school. Well, think about it in your own school. If a student has been trained here 1 year and the next year goes to a teacher and thinks it's going to be completely different, and the school has no common goal, has no way to deal with that, you're going to get that sense of frustration that somehow what you're putting out the window can wipe out the next. Or conversely, that someone maybe the year before you is doing something so different from you that when you get the student, you have to set it back from scratch. A good school aligns its curriculum and does a whole series of things that cause a magnifying effect. Research can support this. There's also some other things that have to improve. They have culture. You need to transfer from one building to another. You notice the bottom line also is a different feeling, a different culture. And sometimes those cultures support improvement, sometimes those cultures just drag it down. And you know, it's nothing you can put your finger on. Sometimes it's just in one school, everyone's kind of together, and they're always putting things together, and someone has some trouble, they're right there to help them. In the next school, they're talking about each other all the time, and everyone's in a little clique, and it's all political. And you can't do anything if you don't want to stand out. Well, that's what I mean by culture, and that's why the school is the appropriate unit of analysis. And it's why sometimes the research on this has shown in a number of demonstration projects around the nation. I'll give you one example. that putting a lot of money into school does not necessarily make any difference if the culture is not one that is aligned around improvement, focused on teachers' learning. So, the school's unit analysis. The other thing about the model is pretty interesting, and perhaps a little bit perhaps controversial. I don't think it is, but I think it's more possible than anything else. You notice that what we can see fundamentally tangible characteristics like the money that's put into it, but also there's an intangible. Things that interesting, our own common sense tells us has to be there for the school to succeed. Some people look at it and say, well, why do you want to do an intangible? You say that with us. Why don't you worry about it? Those are the important messages to send to school today. If you're not attending to these things, the money doesn't exist. If you're an intern in school, not only is it sending some money that says this could cause student learning problems, but it's also sending a message that says you need principal leadership. You need parent involvement. You need an orderly learning environment. Now, if you're not doing better with those messages, received, right, will be closer. The money part has gotten closer, as opposed to the poor old superintendent having to go battle for money for the district, and the superintendent is feeling that once the district gets the money, the superintendent's job is basically done. I've got money for the budget for this year. The idea is that if the message is real clear that the money comes with strings attached, the strings are that you attend to these, what I call intangibles, the things that in some cases may be more important than the money itself. The number of hours of homework, the students' time limit that they complete, the internal alignment of your curriculum. There's just costs associated with these things, but the model counts for them. In other words, it's like training dollars and professional development, release time. Asset money for books and supplies in overall results. But the notion is that if you attend to these things, there's an intangible part to the cost. People can waste their professional development money. Are you believe it? If you can use their professional development time or money and money, that's really not much relationship to student learning. This is an answer to that how you do that. So,
Representative Janella.
Yeah, I almost forgot what my question is. The intangible, what were you just saying?
I was talking about the intangible and how they can be
more
important than intangible because it's influencing student achievement and learning effectiveness.
Would you give me an example of an intangible?
Sure. Principal leadership is a pretty good example. It's one that's been documented and probably over 20, 30 studies have shown that the leadership ability of the principal is going to be a very important variable in how well the school functions and improves students. Parent involvement will be another one that technically, there's no cost directly associated with parent involvement. In other words, you don't pay the parent to be involved. You know, you pay a teacher, in other words, to reduce the class ratio. So parent involvement, teacher leadership, and those things are things that don't necessarily have a direct budget in their
Yes, and perhaps what does the presentation wrong? I'd like to have an answer to this. I have jumped ahead right there, and I was talking about the underlying assumptions. To go back to why a model is needed, and then I come to one of your underlying assumptions is that this prototype is close to an urban area and large enough for a full range of central office services. That is not true of many of our schools, so I wonder how you transpose or adjust or whatever.
Take a look, because many of these companies are not true. Most urban cities. That's a good example of one, right? Maybe you have a few more in it, but I go just send you one more page, and then I'll answer the question in the context of that very next day. So as you've done already, we're going to talk about some of the underlying assumptions. These are not meant to be totally nervous system functions. In many cases, they're very close to nervous system, but in some cases, they're slightly more challenging. We say, put a little more effort into nervous system, but it's a bit more challenging than the nervous system. We said that it's not necessarily a nervous system school, nor a school that's totally rural either. It's in a situation that maybe is reflective of a certain stratum of Oregon schools, but not all. And we may have assumptions about the principle of teacher studies. Those assumptions tend to come out in research that I've done over the last 5 years on teachers' attitudes, principles of attitudes about reform. But the research that I've done doesn't suggest that teachers are wild about reform. It suggests the principles are a little more positive than the teachers. But this is the reason they can slightly optimistic point of view. As opposed to constructing a model that says, you know, nobody really wants to do this, how are we making them do it? Now that's a different model. So we have to make some of these assumptions from the point of view that it can work. If we built a model that had nothing in it, but parents did in Oregon, we would have a skew in a very odd way. High schools, for example, in Oregon are clustered around a bunch of big ones, and they're zillion smaller ones. And when you go to the average high school size, you've got around 640 or something. Each of the sizes is really smaller than what is representative of a wide range of thinking sites. We use 1,000 for the high school, even though it's not the average. Because one can scale down that 1,000 and scale up that 1,000 pretty well. So if you go to 640 or 500 for the high school size, you can't scale that in the same way. But the elementary school, a 346 elementary school can be scaled to 700 or 680, which is a double, with almost no trouble at all. It can be reduced pretty much in half. Pretty much in half. But you'll start to reduce inefficiency when you go to 170. If your principal will still come up to the same. In other words, 640 and 680 is a little more efficient. 170 is a little less efficient. 340 was a pretty good size. You got a fair amount of use out of your principal, you kept that old principal busy. You can also justify some other services at that size. The research also tends to support that kind of size as a pretty good size. You can get the kind of results that you want. So, these are decisions that were made because we had to start the model somewhere. Now, I can grant you the heartbeat that for 2 years we may decide that some of these assumptions were not perfect assumptions. But that's in the nature of an assumption at all. It happens, sorry. And I think we can certainly be criticized by saying you made assumptions. The alternative would have been, however, not Gardner's point. Unless we develop it totally off of average data in order to people to use it. So we can sort of say that. So, in elementary school and high school, I want to get 300 elementary students, 500 for middle, 1,000 for high school. Salaries reflect the average salaries, we talk about the Yale and the But let's come back to this notion that it doesn't reflect what a rural school is. We would have to, if we started to just squeeze you from under base center, we'd have to ask ourselves, how is a rural school different? But keep in mind what I said earlier about the weighting. We have a rural weighting, by the way. Let that out. We have a rural weighting. We rolled all the weightings in. If we had a poverty weighting, rural weighting, specialized weighting, you rolled them all in. We developed a school without reference to the weighting. What that means is, we said, well, if you use all the money, divided it up by all the kids, this is the kind of program you could make. So what's the assumption? The smaller might be more resources. If it was different in different ways, it might need some different types of resources. We didn't attempt to deal with the distributional issues because it would have been we would have to produce a multiple model of rural, urban, could we do that? The answer is yes. Yes. Could the model create an urban school that is different? And then could we create a category of organisms that's called urban school and distribute money in that fashion? The answer is yes. Am I comfortable saying we ought to try to do that in 1999? The answer is no. It was enough to try to get this done as a concept so that we could have good people like yourself take a look at it think about how that improves. I thought that was that an adequate first step. The distributional effect should wait until we think this through, and then see if it's one way down. And the other thing is, if you really want the database to come online, pull it. We have good comparison data, and know really what we're talking about. We also pull high-cost specialized students out. High-cost specialized, we define it as students that cost more than 4.5 times, it was 4.5 times, it was about 500, but it was about 4.5 times the cost of an average student. And the assumption was that if it fits 4.5 times, you know, above that, the state keeps it in the first day. The reason we did that is that if you didn't do that, it would have skewed the model. If you put one high-cost special education student into the school, it can throw you off because that individual could cost you anywhere from $50,000 to $100,000, which would then make it impossible to model in the charter type hypothetical fashion. And we did our best. We try to get our best estimate of how much the students cost, and it's difficult to do. No one receives those data, although they're working on it now. We ran around and asked everybody about it, and everyone started working on it. You will have a figure on that, I believe, on what the true amount of high-cost special education is, and what it would cost to move that off of the shoulders of the district and run it out of the state's cost. And I believe if that is where all the encouragement is, you would accomplish something very significant. So small districts absolutely have difficulty meeting their legal requirements and doing what they know is right for the kids in their charge, especially if it's at the same time that they deal with their business. Given that they can't go to the local voting and raise their budget, they have to raise their budget. So, we think there's still enough high cost to raise their budget. This doesn't cover capital costs, doesn't cover enough of this, but it's all trying to figure it out. Once again, it has to do with the charge that we had before. Some of the figures that the general fund budget is not every possible that there is. This last thing is very misleading, and I've actually rewritten the slides that I used to describe that. It does not cover maintenance costs at school. The model builds into it that we believe to be more realistic figures about what it takes to maintain the school. We believe that a lot of districts are currently under-researching the maintenance of their facilities, and that even if you put the money in now, around if we use average figures, we'd be spending in the wrong place. That would hurt us. So, just pointing out here, we use a different number rather than an average to determine what we think that would make.
Oh, nice. Representative Gino.
The maintenance, is that the, what type of thing is that? Is that the
building up the electrical,
janitorial,
cellular,
okay.
And you can tell you all the categories for management.
That would be things like routine maintenance, painting is a big one that you can't issue bonds for. So any of this, we try to define it as the types of ongoing kind of maintenance and repairs and cleaning and upkeep in a building that a local district would need to fund from the state, that they can't go out and issue bonds. You can issue bonds to do a major capital project, but not for just your ongoing maintenance. That needs to be an operating budget.
I would point out to you that the definition probably exists in the real or very specific terms in that Nancy has. In other words, we didn't make up that category of units that are now being put in place as a result of the database. So she could say the exact thing from the category.
Well, do we have a copy of that? No, sure.
Nancy, could you provide us with a copy,
of
what? A chart of accounts?
Well, you'll see that not every category in our model corresponds directly with the database initiative category, but very quickly we did have the database initiative category. And one of the reasons why is that the database initiative is a challenge we call them. And one of the reasons that we put in some other categories, I'll give you an example, we put in a category called copying clause, which is not a database development, but it's an important cost in schools and one that probably ought to be monitored. Additional time for the student learning is in the model. It's not broken out. I don't think the database is kind of accept the process. But that would be permanent school, active school programs, even programs, extra costs if we bring out that regular program. We have a definition of responsible retirement collect information. We're going to have standards that's going to require some students to receive more support than others. We need to find out what that's
called. I might just interject here for a moment. This actually is an opportunity to talk about the database and the model. The two of them together will complement each other so we'll have the best data in the end. The database will respond to the needs that we have in the model to identify what the elements are. So over time, you'll have this response so that they're working in concert and not, being just each one individually by themselves. So there's a complementary effect there that will only happen over time as it develops process.
Representative Janel.
Madam Chairman, you were talking about the copy machines or the copies? And would that, do you know, is that at, like, say, 1 cent per page? If it was 1 cent per page, it would be 2,520 copies per
right.
child, or?
Well, you know what? It is around that, isn't it? It's 1.5 cents.
They're about,
per school, not per child.
That's per school, not per child?
The model is a school copy budget in Portland, Eugene, and I think one other district. So we compare, we broke it down on a per pupil basis in those three districts, and then we average the money, and then we applied it to the 340 students. You know what the end of that figure, what we came up with, that's the figure that we got from the district that had to do some special kind of off-the-book figuring to get us to us. And that should include the lease, paper, maybe some copies. So there's going to be a couple of days.
Representative Janel.
Well, will someone be walking us through this so that we understand the part about per school or per child?
Okay, thanks. The last slide is the basic components of the program. We're exercising the students. And in a moment, we're going to start doing this. So, the first thing we do is we use the database initiative when we have data from it. Keeping in mind it's a pilot, and we use what we have, and keeping in mind that in some cases, we believe the database figures might have been due to positive specific conditions or conditions that were involved. If we believe that the database number wasn't exactly correct, we try to adjust it based on going out and getting other information. We just research on effective education practices, my background is in education policy, and effective education in school improvement. That's sort of things that bring some background. We're also using resources. We have the education and some professional organizations, associations, and state and data information on every salary, and so forth. And where we have no other reference form, we got down, people said, what's it really cost for your school? What's it really cost for your district? We collected enough information so that we were getting the same answer over and over again, and we decided that's probably a pretty good starting place for this particular element. So in some cases, we went to the practitioners, we went to the school, and then what we did is kind of compare. Nancy Connigan did a lot of work on this, became an unsung hero role, I would say. And she would take a look at a lot of this and say, does this really make sense? Is this really kind of what schools look like? Is this close? So we weren't trying to do the average, but we were trying to come up with a school that at least approximated an active life of a real school. And our estimation is this. Now, when you compare it to any given school in Oregon, it's going to be wrong. When you compare it to your school, it's not going to be your school, but our notion is starting to get this prototype notion where we integrate all the pieces into a big school. So with that, I'm not going to go through all the 4.95, 5.65, and all that. You can take a look at that. That's really for a different purpose. What I would call your attention to now, this is something to model.
on start on page right after page 56 of page 49. So those of you who are not sequential,
it's the benchmark.
It would be confusing. I apologize for this. It's the section that's going to start the Oregon example cost of a quality of shipping, and that's on page 54. Then follow page 55, 56, and 49.
Your numbers are different than mine. Say that one again.
There's 256.
I want 54, and it's not labeled. My 54 is not. Does not look like that. It has right there page 54. 254. You and I have the similar thing. Their 54 is
different than ours. Yeah, that's the typewritten 56. And it says the Soviet station model, elementary school, close communication.
Okay, 49.
Yeah, it looks like the student is in 49.
So that's not...
We
have more than one page 54. That's so here, you want to turn... No, here's where you want to go. You go back like I did to the type, you know, not the type of nothing. And I think you can
tell.
It's like a jigsaw.
Once somebody's here,
thanks, Dick.
Good school instruction. Look on your neighbor.
We all got together here.
Yeah, you guys are on the lot.
Very close, though.
We're impressed.
Some of us know how to listen to instructions.
We did. No, we did. And then Vic came and told us what it was. So I think this is
with now the question was to walk through here. And I'm going to ask you to keep your thumb in the space so you don't lose your place. Heaven forbid you could lose your place. That's the problem with that. I'm going to ask you at the same time.
Okay.
To locate another page to avoid. It's going to be right after all of these models. And then the numbering is going to begin. And you'll find page 69, the technical manual. It's about 26 pages from where you are. Page 59, technical manual for every model. Imagine this page, and you'll see that in the left-hand column, it has the elementary component. It has the data source.
Yep. Yeah, it's you know, it's capital.
The reason I'm trying to have to keep this up there is I want you to be able to come back and forth to the next question. You go first to the technical panel and see the answer to the question. And turn to your curiosity and answer any question that you like. But I want to make sure you do that we have this written down for you in some detail.
You don't know how to number.
Keeping in mind that what I'm trying to do now is explain the model. And when you say model, when I say model, I don't mean the specific way in which you said you do that mixed number sequence. I mean the fact that these elements are used in functional groups. Keeping in mind that you can put any number of features in this or not have the features, whatever you want. The model is the framework, and that's really what we're talking about tonight, the framework. So, if you walk through this framework, you start with first step, you see kindergarten, first through third, fourth through fifth, and the next column would be the FTE allotted to that, 2, 9, and 5. And you see the cost for 2 FTE, 9 FTE, and 5 FTE.
Mm-hmm.
And you see a brief explanation that's hard to read. That's why the technical manual came here, so it's a little more... A little better explanation. So if you were to flip back then to the text on page 59, you'd see an explanation column. Some things about the elementary salary. If you're curious how we came up with the salary, you see on the next page some information on the class size, how that was that you to be? And so forth. So, the model section needs to be kind of forward back to one of the section here. Doesn't have detail in the two right-hand columns, but it's the descriptive. And you have to put that with a technical manual to get more detailed explanation of sometimes what those mean. So it's kind of a combination of another way to train everything on the way to teach it right along. This is why we did a mission on 100% of the program. I'm not really sure. Program staff would be other types of teachers that you use in an elementary school, special education staff. Now, and this is the full implementation piece. So we talked about an instructional improvement coordinator, something that does not exist in any elementary school learning that I'm aware of, and there may be somewhere it does. And once again, we try to make the average school. We said an important part of getting students to standards would be a teacher to have instructional support. So they had students who weren't making the standard, they had a teacher in the building, a half-time teacher to come in and help them with a lesson plan or design, or help them with a strategy. I guess the kind of question you have to ask yourself, would that make a difference in your school? Is that person more available or a highly skilled person? So that's an assumption. We think it's sort of a high-cost benefit. You pay a certain amount for a good long term. Keep in mind, all the salary teachers in school, total compensation costs. And that's why they look a little high. It includes all the same benefits. On the next page, the administrative accountability is
acceptable. I'm sorry. That's true. That's question. Representative Janelle.
Well, we're on page 2, and we're down with the column additional instruction time.
Okay, you've got kind of me by
the special
page. Do you want to talk about that now?
No, I can wait. I can wait.
Okay, now we're on page 2, which is page 50.
Well, I was on page 2.
Okay.
Dixon over here.
50 also has a 2 on it.
Yeah.
50 has a 2 on it.
The one that starts up here, computer hardware software.
Okay.
You have a different one on that thing.
I think it's from here. That page two, right there. Right there. All right. That's
just so you know, as you're looking through these matrix pages, what you're seeing is this entire explanation for full implementation at the elementary level. Then it shows you the middle school level,
right.
Then the high school level.
Basic implementation at the elementary level. Then it shows much of your range.
And it's,
no,
it's
all the
it is page 2 and
it says full implementation.
All the schools are together and then all the stage. And again, this is a work in progress. And I apologize to the doctor here.
I'm kidding, Margie. The next column that on page 50 is administrative accountability of principal's position. So it's given the full-time principal. Once again, we said where the information came from. This particular one came from the Coastal Administrative Salary Survey. It's just average salary for principal. So the principal salary is one of those things where we feel like an average figure isn't too bad to use. The range is restricted enough where it seems like a reasonable figure. Computer hardware and software. It's not a specific line item for a specific element in the database, but we use it because of the importance of technology in our schools and the demand for people to know how we're using technology. So we include it for a specific accountability reason. Now, what's the difference between computers and student learning? It's an evolving technology. I'm not going to stand here and tell you that more computers could just try student learning. On the other hand, I'm not going to say they're getting rid of computers if you want to use. It's an evolving technology. It's here not because there's a one-to-one correspondence between computers and learning, but because they can be powerful tools can use in integrated programs. But from an accountability point of view, people want to know, do we have them or not? The slides book for materials break down into text, classroom materials, copying, media center materials, and teacher reimbursement materials purchases. That last column is another one of those things that used to exist in Oregon schools and tends not to exist anymore. It's not a high cost item, but it's one of those things that we believe will make a phenomenal difference in the lives of students in the classroom.
Representative Erdogan.
Yes, thank you. There's not a very good heading here, and so maybe you can explain it. And that is the heading for element cost. Is this per something, per total, per thousand?
Everyone.
Everything in the element cost is for the school.
But it's prototype school.
Correct. This is for the school. We're building the school, and these are costs for each of these elements.
Yeah, but if you look at the last two columns, you will see that they are calculated. For instance, the teacher reimbursement materials is calculated at $10 for students. You multiply that by 342 students,
okay. Excuse me, could you come up and identify yourself for the record?
I'm sorry, Peggy Lynch.
The same holds true in the technical assistance manual. It holds true as well, but that right-hand column in the manual tends to give you the per student cost as well. That's why I suggest you want to flip back and forth between those. That we try to do that cost in two places when it's just on the standard for people cost, and get that easier.
Dr. Conley, really quickly.
Excuse me. You know, each time one or the other speaks, you need to identify yourself because you don't know who's talking.
Thank you, Lynn. I just want to make sure that the representative's answer on copy is also there. If you look at the last column, you will see that there's a calculation of the number of copies that they expected that a student would need to have per year. And then you do the multiplication times 1.5 cents per copy, which seems to be the market rate for copies, and do the calculations and do the math again for the 340 students, and that's how you get the number in column 4.
So it is a per year, is what you're talking about.
That's per, and it's for multiple kinds of things.
Right,
Representative Erdogan.
I'm sorry, Representative Erdogan. Yes, I understand you now, but the labels aren't very clear, but now it's clear.
So if we continue on through here, I just kind of give you the highlights. It's all very quickly, so we don't spend all the time on this. If you go in the category of supplies, books, and materials, what you'll see is that we have made some categories there that may be a little different than your school budget. So if you look at this, you might find your school budget lumps together a couple of these. For example, very often classroom materials and equipment could end up lumped together with text, consumables, and classroom text. But we use database definitions on this, with the exception of the copying that we did on that. And therefore, it might look a little different than your budget. So if you're preparing your school price, not unless you've got one. Unless you're a school with a database, maybe you might have coded it.
Madam Chair.
Representative Erdogan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking here, and I guess I'm rather astonished, and I'd like to ask, some schools do not use text, do not use them at all?
Some elementary schools use classroom text. Some use literature-based programs. Some use consumable materials. And I would once again defer to those members of the committee to discuss this. We were basing this off the range of factors that exist in our community. So, the teacher reimbursement materials purchases, once again, I have to point out, is something that you won't find in your budget in most cases. We think it makes a tremendous difference in the ability to get students to standard. If you can buy an extra book for a student, you can come up with an extra activity for a student. A very small investment there can build a very large return in terms of student motivation and involvement in achieving. Professional training and development, there's 10 days for all teachers, but it's a combination of extended contracts and substitute days, 5 of each with an ocean. But the idea is schools will have to come up with a creative solution to the time. So we've assumed there'll be some of both, some of substitutes, some of early release, some of extended contracts for people to work on curriculum planning in the summers, what have you. We've also provided enough money for every PCF 10 days when I'm not sure in every case that that would be true. However, the model doesn't apply to make a distinction like that. This would allow for a teacher to have 20 days to develop a unit that all the other teachers do. Every teacher would have to spend the same amount of time.
Yes, ever, but I have another question.
Representative Erdogan.
Thank you. I have another question. How did you come up with this per diem costs $200. That's higher than federal per diem. That's higher than state per diem substantially. So I'd like to know.
For the record, I'm Nancy Heiligman. The cost is a blend. As Dr. Conley said, it's based on part substitute time and part teacher per diem time. And I believe the teacher per diem rate, including all costs, was $280 a day. And a substitute rate is, I think, $140. And so it's a combination of the two.
That is, once again, the $200 is not meant to pay anyone $200 a day. It means that the price of those things you might be paying from the $280 a day, which is a contract rate. It's not a federal per diem rate. If you extended the contract with these individuals, you would pay them at their contract rate for each day you extended. The $137 is a substitute cost that if you release the person per day, that's when you pay a substitute teacher. The $200 is the splitting of the difference between the two. Basically, to say about 5 days a week.
No, but I'll think about it.
You could have put in 5 substitute days, 5 extended contract days, but the principle that we wanted to illustrate was that we weren't trying to prescribe the number of days that you would need that could for teachers, that you wouldn't prescribe any teacher 5 days or 5 substitute days or 5 extended contract days. And so
it's
kind of a situation that's
kind of
very restrictive and
blaming. Well, the question just was, which federal per diem rate are you talking about?
Well, basically, what I was just trying to focus on, what you were actually counting here, it didn't have to be the federal or the state per diem, and I'm still not clear, because it seems to me when teachers are released or when they have a training day, that is the day they normally would be in the classroom. So it seems to me that the cost, and they wouldn't get paid for being at something else other than the classroom, because they're getting paid for that, and the cost would only be the cost of a substitute.
That was Representative Oberlein. I'm going to insist that you state your name for the record.
Yes.
Yes.
We assume it's a certain amount of release time. That every school in does it already, every teacher's pay is not adequate. But in the survey data, it picks up in the 67% range, which is saying it's not adequate time. So what we're not doing here is we're not accounting for something that doesn't cost anything like that. We're accounting for things that cost about that. So let's say that you're working to figure out how to align the curriculum in your school. You might need to substitute days to go meet with other people at another grade level to do this. You wouldn't dismiss the whole faculty, but maybe a group of 3 or 4 teachers to go do this. Then, maybe as a faculty to decide that you need some more lessons for students who are in need of a lot of teaching around particular standards. You might decide that you want 5 teachers to have an extended contract for 15 days in the summer to your plan. That's where the extra days come into play. The idea is not simply to have more and more release days. One of the things that parents have said is that those release days seem to have kind of reached their limit in terms of the effect that it has on them. So the model does not simply write in some release days. It assumes some of that's going on and then provides real resources to account for the additional time that you have.
Yeah, Judy Werbelow. I'm Representative Werbelow. I think we're not communicating well, but I think this is an extended conversation and the time is running short, so I will talk.
Judy, can you and kind of get together afterwards?
We will pursue this.
And then on the additional instructional time for students, you'll see that we put time in for 60 students there before we summer school.
Representative
Madam Chairman, Dr. Conley, I was looking ahead on this column, and it says 60 students for 4 weeks of summer school. Does that mean that they failed, or what does that mean?
The assumption here is that a portion of students have not met the standard, that they will benefit the most from summer school. This is not every student who didn't meet the standard. visit the students who will help us the most. The occasion is practices the students who have been running from the school, and it's any that the group of students will really benefit from that intensive extra effort. There are many other students who haven't met the standard. Keep in mind, this is an elementary school. And that many of the other students can't meet the adjustment other than the elementary
school. Okay, that's true.
Okay.
Dr. Conley, when you say haven't met the standard, does that mean failed?
No, that would be an interpretation I think each individual would have to make. It doesn't mean that they're held back in a grade. Is that what you mean?
Right.
That, no, it does not mean that they're held back in a grade. It means that it does not mean the benchmark standard of grade 3 or 5 on the Oregon assessment.
Thank you.
Let's keep in mind that this is a model. And I don't want to not get too much into some of the detail because recognizing that a model can be changed.
But, Madam Chairman, we do need to know what we're looking at or we wouldn't be, and we wouldn't be having any input or come out with anything, I think.
Thank you.
You have to keep in mind here that, first of all, we're talking about a full implementation, and I don't know if we've emphasized that as much as we should have. Not necessarily saying what percentage, and we can get a discussion about that, 80-90%. Remember, we are building a model that is going to allow the students to meet the standards. That's not where we are today. So we're talking about a full implementation. That's our remediation that Dr. Tong was talking about. And everything she now was discussing about here is that this might not be just third graders that didn't meet their benchmark. This could be first, second graders that people know are having problems. Teachers are very well aware. They might not have taken a test for that benchmark. But this second grader is not up to the standards they think they need to be in order to be able to learn very step soon to take some summer school. So that's the kind of flexibility that's in this model. But I think somehow we're not almost on the wrong, kind of on the right course here, that this is designed to have the students meet the standards. And it's not where we are today. This is a full implementation model. So I think maybe that'll help a little bit, and that's how we're going down this road and why we're putting things in the summer school.
And that's why we're asking questions.
And that's exactly right. And I'm just trying to clarify. That's why that's the basis that we're talking about. That's the full implementation we need.
Okay, I'm going to move on next to additional instructional time, centralized support costs. All the elements of centralized support costs and district administrative will test directly out of the database initiative using their definition and their values from the database, with the exception of we've adjusted the maintenance one upward a little bit. As I mentioned, operation plant maintenance, we have set that above the database initiative average because a couple of the districts in the database initiative pilot are ones that have far below average cost. But all of those are right out of the database initiative, and Nancy can give you the details on how those are figured. But I think they're relatively self-explanatory. The comment I would make is that, taking as a whole now, this model explains all of the costs the school districts have. The portion out to school centralized costs, even the person says the class together, a portion to the school centralized costs. No school spends $81,940 in transportation. That's its apportioned cost of the district expense for transportation. That's true for each of the component elements below that. You've got an operation by maintenance. The school does not have a budget of $136,680 for maintenance. if that is a reflection of the total district budget allocated out over all of the students in that school and at the other school level, all of the students.
Thank you, Representative. But so then you have to go back to the foundation. How is it determined what will be allocated to the district to arrive at this figure, which may or may not be allocated for a specific school?
Once again, that's a question of distribution formula, and I think it'd be pretty bad to say that if we move in the direction of the state, we're going to have to come back and do what the distribution formula is.
So if you haven't if you haven't dealt with it, then where did you get the figures we have now?
Once again, our charge is to determine what we think we pay. Realistically, to assume that we can get a certain portion of students in the understanding. What we did was develop a school, we allocated all the costs out to the school to see what that cost. We did not suggest that a school should get this school should get this amount of money. It suggests that we multiply all the elementary students in Oregon, multiply the middle school model by all the middle school students in Oregon, multiply the high school model by all the high school students in Oregon, you get an overall number for a possible budget. That's all you get. You don't get for it. And should we in the future think about those distribution issues? The answer is yes. That's the charge for this particular council meeting.
Madam Chairman, Dr. Conley, it says assumed self-supporting food services program. Are the food service programs self-supporting right now?
Yes, in the elementary level, they tend to be. Middle school, they tend to be. High school, they tend not to be. And we're finding this model, but we do put some money in the high school. It compensates for the fact that those 50 high school kids just leave campus and go eat at Burger King. And so the high school food services seem to be less self-supporting, but elementary and middle is not truly the district. But I must mention, this is a good example of a place where we decided that many districts can do this. We're assuming it as an efficiency. That means if your district is not self-supporting, you would look at this model and you would say, for a teacher in your school district, your food service was not self-supporting. You could have to think slightly why it's not self-supporting.
Any additional questions?
My feeling is that we don't need to go to the middle and the high school unless we self-serve you to the purpose because the explanations are 85% the same. There are small variations. We have more detail on the classified staff at the middle and the high school. We have on nurse positions. We have a couple other things in the position, but I feel that based on this explanation, you should probably be comfortable looking at the model itself.
I do have one question, and it has to do with your outcome assumption where, 90% performance, and what happens to the other 10%.
The first part is how do you come up with 90%? The second part is what about the other 10? And let me answer the first part first. If I could refer to the section in the technical manual, hopefully your thumb is still there or somewhere there. On page 59, I ask you to go. Page 62, you'll see a bibliography, and in part, that's designed to support the notion that it is not unreasonable to assume that you have to complain. The notion that 90% is not unrealistic is based on a series of research studies that, taken in their entirety, support the types of activities suggested and that furthermore supports the notion that having more than one of these happening at the same time reinforces them such that they're stronger than any individual activity. For example, if you plot size reduces on that, we've done a thorough study, I'm familiar with it, I might have the data on it right now if you don't mind, but in and of itself, it does a certain amount. We can get into what it does and what it does. However, if you combine it with parent involvement, if you combine it with an instructional assistant coordinator, if you combine it with some of the other things we're suggesting here, the evidence is much more compelling. So that's the first question. The second question, which is what refers to the other 10% question. We were thinking when we wrote this is that at this point, there's probably some portion of students will not have been in the program long enough to test their own good in college state or be in some other category where it's not to say that they don't want to reach a hand or reach a hand out of hand and not influence over them at that point to get them to that specific time. And it may be that we find that there is some proportion of students that may be very responsible for it who have physiological limitations that cause them not to be able to change. And we don't know what that figure is yet, but we're assuming there's some percent, hopefully a very small percent, may not be physiologically capable of this number. So that's the basis for that.
Mrs. Kirkwood.
But you could take the same model and systematically identify the kids who weren't making it, build your model with the functions and the elements and components you needed to get those to the standard as well. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it depends on your definition of
what. Dr. Cummings.
when people use the word all, they have very different definitions of that word, I think. And all I'm saying is you better start with what's clear about what is meant by that.
The hour is getting late. What I would like to do is to invite you back, because I believe that there's a lot of questions that some of us have, and if you would be amenable to coming back before us, we would like to invite you back again. Andy.
Madam Chair, I guess one question that I missed along the way somewhere in terms of information would be, what specific group of people came up with the individual things in the model? And I understand what we looked at was a four implementation model. But if, you know, one thing I noticed in there was full day kindergarten, which right now I'm not aware of any school district that has such a thing. Who were the people that made a decision that was the right idea for that or any other of the hundreds of different recommendations in there?
There are various work groups that were established. The work group on class size, the work group on additional instructional time, the work group on professional development, the work group on operations and children. Those were derived in part from a study done by the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, and Ozzy is still here, and he could certainly comment on that for you, called the Keys to a Quality Education, in which the school administrators of the state said, these are the things that we think make the most difference. If you give us the money, we will succeed with students. The council took Keys to a Quality Education, looked at it, and said this is a reasonably well-developed and thoughtful document, and it's strictly the superintendent saying that this is what they need to do it, mm-hmm. and committing themselves to do this. This is a reasonable component. Then, from there, went on to examine the research, and as I mentioned, the bibliography that suggests some of those sources, and consult with school people about what works in their school district, talk with experts, and add some of the things to that. The counselors, for example, the notion that in the middle of the high school, you would reduce the teacher ratio. You'd have more counselors. No one, the COSA piece did not say to do that. But in talking with educators and reading the literature and thinking about what we need to STEM, it's clear that there's a group of kids that need our attention more than any different classroom teacher, or maybe even for him, we're not sure yet. And that the Oregon Reformed team suggests that would be a very cost-beneficial investment. The research on counselors, the point is that for every element we can give you a detailed answer to your question, I'm giving you a generalized response. COSA plus effective schools research plus some very specific things that seem to relate to Oregon.
One more just for the record again, Madam Chair. Just take the council for example. I have to remember we're also talking about quality. We're not talking about good reading, reaching standards. And I think most people would argue that the council has something to do with the quality of the student that we turn out of a high school or whatever. All the ramifications of the total person that we're trying to develop. So, you've got to remember there's both aspects that we're working with. But very much important to that discussion.
Mm-hmm. Linda? Along that line of thinking, I just want to comment on something that is in this quality education model that I find very offensive. It says it to be a quality education model, and the program staff talks about music and teaching and art and media. And then it says some of these positions are needed for order prep.
What happened?
Just a minute now.
This version you have is not the version. This particular is the facts version. Not the most current version. This was done in a work group setting to explain to a work group why you put a component in there. It is not a version that is ever meant to be in this. This is not this version anyway. It's talking to people about why. Some people don't understand. Some people do not understand why you have something like that.
Okay, I don't think you understand either, because if you let me think, what I want to say is, in a quality education, you do not provide music and teaching in those other classes in order to cover prep time. A quality education in those areas is provided to more completely develop the child. So I don't understand why that's even in there.
Okay, Tom, once again,
I have a question. When will the model report be completed, Lynn? Do you have a target date for completing that?
It hasn't. Maybe Mark can talk more specifically to that. Mark is not going to be the name of that.
Mark, as you would guess, this is a work in progress. The council finished its effort that now it has begun to spend a lot of hours and time developing what it wants to feel very comfortable with as a published document and a final report. And so that's why I was asking Harvey to be sure that we really didn't distribute anything yet very far, because this document is edited and is being changed as the council continues to meet and as it improves and it makes some of its final recommendations. So having said that, I would think we're probably a week away from the document that we want to send.
Pardon?
Yeah, I mean, you're looking at a draft for a printer that needs to be designed and typed in, and then there'll be finished up. So we're probably looking at even another couple of weeks.
Okay. So we will, once we have the completed document, so that it's not confusing to individuals here that this is a working document. I think I explained that at our last meeting, that it is draft, it is in process, and it is evolutionary as they work it, and we will call you back when you get the final document completed.
And it will be numbered consecutively.
Okay.
Charlie Irish from Salem. My question would be, has the model been validated? And here's my thought. Have you taken your three models and multiplied it out? And then with respect to the costs that are actually in for your people, and amplify that to the state of Oregon, and how closely does that match the current funding?
Well,
right. The cost location model is multiplied out to $5.65 billion. The model does not attempt to duplicate or replicate the current state of affairs. It attempts to create a vision for the Western public. Now, when you're actually sitting down to site, it's appropriate to have it driven down to the current amount that you're all waiting for. When you're waiting for it, you're not going to be able to reflect on the state of affairs. So it's not designed to try to somehow replicate the current school. It's designed to show what the program is the way we put all in. But when you multiply that, if I think it's about the full implementation with 4.95 to 3, the basic implementation focuses on K-3 with additional time to student learning, time to professional development, and all the other grades, and most helpful to develop.
Follow up.
I just have to say, this is not supposed to emulate. I know it's difficult. We could have done that. We could have gone out and taken any school and started with the school. We could have done it. We could have done it.
Audrey, would you like to come forward?
Madam Chair, the record of Audrey Rose was the head of our school district and Mr. Arnold's question. This staffing, this quality of curriculum, this supply, most teachers in our state were skillful. This is not what we have in Oregon. This is what we believe we need if we're going to have all of our kids meet the standards we set. And if you understand our standards, they are very high. This is not about school reform. It's about improvement. And I want to, and I think the word all in my school is the 5.6 billion. The 90% is a figure that they put on and they do an implementation phase. And I think that's part of the intent you get to talk to them. But you can't validate it in the sense of what's going on right now. Music teachers, PE teachers, not to have a pressure, but to give a kid a really good music quality experience, a quality physical education experience in the elementary that makes them understand what health is all about. That doesn't fit in one place. This model is successful.
Representative Wilson.
Before I get out of here, I wanted to especially thank all the teachers for being here. We really appreciate your time. You work at Ground Zero, and you understand these things perhaps better than most of us do. So I appreciate that. I also, before I left, wanted to salute a friend and the teacher, Tom Gentry, from Grants Pass, who's driven 200 miles for a two-hour meeting and is going to turn right around and drive 200 more to get home. And so I appreciate that kind of dedication to practice.
Stay longer. Representative Lundquist.
I might ask you to answer more on this question here. Let's not lose sight of the reason for the model. The model is not to validate what we're doing today. The model is to validate what it would cost to provide the education that we want our students to have and to meet the standards. Those are two entirely different things. And because today, if we were to validate it, and then respect, I don't know the figure, 30% or 40% of the kids meeting standards in some particular figure, that's not what this model is designed to do. This model is designed to have them reach those standards. Now, we can alter some, I mean, that's the real positive aspect of the model. This gentleman over here was asking about kindergarten. I'm not just sure what he had in mind, but I'm going to present. Let's assume that you might have questioned whether we have a full-day kindergarten or not. Okay, and so I don't know if that was the answer, but I'm just saying a person could make that question, you know. Well, then that would alter the model. If we decide that we don't need that to help the students reach the standards, and we'll need a half-day model, then take it out.
That's the beauty of the model. You can make the model function for what performance levels. And let's say we don't want 90% of the students to meet the standards. We say in Oregon, we don't want to fund that. We don't want to put that much money into the system. We want to fund 75%. We can put that kind of aspects into the model and make those decisions. It's that linking again between funding and performance.
Nancy Heiligman, yes, we did validate the prototype schools against schools in the database that were similar in characteristics and costs. And the costs are based on actual Oregon costs. So, and if you have about the same program elements, you're going to come out with about the same cost. But as David has mentioned, there isn't a prototype school anywhere in Oregon. It's, you know, one doesn't exist.
Representative Mellon, I'm going to make this the last question.
Madam Chairman, I have a question for Representative Lundquist. What I was just curious about, exactly what our role was today in the suggestion with kindergarten, if we felt like half days was the way, what we thought was a normal school day, are we supposed to be saying so, and is there supposed to be input, or are we just reviewing something that's pretty much cut and dry? Because if we knew that, then we wouldn't be asking as many questions. Are we supposed to be putting input into this and helping make any decisions on this, or just basically just reviewing what's already been done?
Madam Chair and Representative Gianella, I'm not too sure Chair Claude speaks to that. I will tell you this, that When I made the statement about the kindergarten, the Council of the Oregon is going to continue to work through this process for the next couple of years to make sure that we can keep the model moving. Any input we have from anybody will be welcome, and I'm not too sure what the total input is. But I just pointed that out from the standpoint of that as an option. I mean, that is how the model works. And the council that we've been working with will continue to keep on top of the model and try to refine the cost, like I said earlier in the discussion.
Point of clarification, this body is charged with refining, making recommendations, not only just for today, but to lead us into the next legislative session. You're not restricted as to your input or your thoughts. You're to think beyond outside of the box, recognizing that the council has given us a framework that's a model, and I think, Lynn said it, that they welcome our input, and so you're not in any way inhibited. You're welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the kindergarten issue is an excellent one to take a look at, because in answer to Representative Gianella, the decision as to whether or not to have a full-day kindergarten or a half-day kindergarten is a very valid one that easily and properly should be undertaken by the local school district. Salem might decide to have half-day. In this model, then, that could reduce the total amount of money that they need. They might allocate that to additional educational assistance to have in the classroom. They might use that to decrease class size in another area. That flexibility is inherent in the model, and that's kind of the beauty of the model and the fact that the dollars can be plugged in accordingly. So it isn't, I don't believe, correct me if I'm wrong, those of you who worked on it, the intent is not to come forward and say, thou shalt have full-day kindergarten. That isn't the intent. That was the one place where they started, but you can still, pardon my body language, mix and match in there to do the things that the local district, through its regular process, determines are important.
We will be...
And maybe this helps explain that whole, this whole conversation we're having right now. If you just remember that the
reason for doing this model is not because then Speaker Lundquist and other lawmakers sat in a room and said, these schools are doing things wrong, and we need to find a better way for them to do what they're doing. It was those same people sitting in a room and saying, we don't know what we're doing. We don't know how much money we should be giving them. We need to develop something that tells us how to do this. It was a lawmaker, not necessarily a school at all for the district. Although we hope you, if there's value in it for the district, great. That was not what it was designed for. It was designed to fill a huge, incredible voice we had here in the legislature in terms of making responsible decisions about school funding. Thank you.
Our next meeting is 2 weeks from now, same time. And I would encourage you, even though this is a working document, it's in draft, I would encourage you to take it home, to review it, and to write down your thoughts and your comments. And during the interim, I will be sending, I will be having Jan get in contact with you because I will be coming up with some specific work groups so that you can decide where your interests are, and I think so we can be a little more manageable in this group. So be thinking about that for the next meeting, and we'll have some refreshments for you as well. Thank you, Tom, for coming such a long distance, and thank all of you for coming. On the issue of kindergarten, I know that Representative Hobson talked about the district, but there is nothing to preclude this group from talking about that, yes, we should have kindergarten as statewide full-time. So you can think outside of this box and be just as innovative, because I personally would like for you to do that. And with that, we're adjourned.